George Powhatan had been right, too. It did you no good to fight for the big things, for civilization, for instance. All you accomplished was getting young girls and boys to believe in you, to throw their lives away in worthless gestures, accomplishing nothing. Bezoar had been right. Powhatan had been right. Even Nathan Holm, monster that he was, had told the essential truth about Ben Franklin and his constitutionalist cronies, how they had hoodwinked the people into believing such things. They had been propagandists to make Himmler and Trotsky blush as amateurs. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Ah! Then there had been the Order of the Cincinnati, made up of George Washington's officers who, halfway embarked one night upon a mutinous coup, were shamed by their stern commander into giving their tearful, solemn vow to remain farmers and citizens first, and soldiers only at their country's need and call. Whose idea had it been, that unprecedented oath? The promise was kept for a generation, long enough for the ideal to set. In essence, it lasted into the era of professional armies and technological war. Until the end of the 20th century, that is, when certain powers decided that soldiers should be made into something more than mere men. The thought of Macklin and his augmented veterans loosed on the unsuspecting Willamettes made Gordon heartsick. But there wasn't anything he or anyone else could do to prevent it. Not a whit can be done about it. But that won't keep the damn ghosts from pestering me. The South Coquille grew more swollen with every mile they slogged as streamlets joined in from the enclosing hills. A gloomy drizzle began to fall, and thunder rumbled in counterpoint to the roaring torrent to their left. As they rounded a bend in the road, the northern sky brightened with distant flashes of lightning. Looking up at the glowering clouds, Gordon almost stumbled into Marcy's back as she came to a sudden halt. He put out his hand to give her a gentle push, as he had been forced to do more and more often the last few miles. But this time her feet were planted. She turned to face him, and in her eyes there was a bleakness that went beyond anything Gordon had seen in 17 years of war. Chilled with a dark foreboding, he pushed past her and looked down the road. 30 yards or so ahead lay the ruins of an old roadside trading post. A faded sign advertised Myrtlewood carvings for sale at fabulous prices. 2 rusted automobile hulks lay half-settled into the mud in front. 4 horses and a 2-wheeled cart were tethered to the slump-sided shack. From under the canted porch roof, General Macklin stood with his arms folded and smiled at Gordon. "Run!" Gordon yelled at the women, and he dove through the roadside thicket, rolling up behind a moss-covered trunk with Johnny's rifle in his hands. As he moved, he knew he was being a fool. Macklin still might have some faint wish to keep him alive, but in a firefight he was already dead. He knew he had leaped on instinct, to get away from the women, to draw attention after himself and give them a chance to get away. "Stupid idealist!" he cursed. Marcy and Heather simply stood there on the road, too tired or too resigned even to move.
"Now that ain't so smart," Macklin said, his voice at its most amiable and dangerous. "Do you think you can manage to shoot me, Mr. Inspector?"
The thought had occurred to Gordon. It depended, of course, on the augment letting him get close enough to try, and on whether the 20-year-old ammo still worked after its dunking in the rogue. Macklin still had not moved. Gordon raised his head and saw through the leaves that Charles Bezoar stood beside the general. Both of them looked like easy targets out there in the open. But as he slid the rifle's bolt and began to crawl forward, Gordon realized, sickly, there were 4 horses. There came a sudden crashing sound from just overhead. Before he could even react, a crushing weight slammed onto his back, driving his sternum onto the rifle stock. Gordon's mouth gaped, but no air would come. He could barely twitch a muscle as he felt himself lifted into the air by his collar. The rifle slipped from nearly senseless fingers.
"Did this guy really waste 2 of ours last year?" a gravelly voice behind his left ear shouted in cheerful derision. "Seems a bit of a wuss to me."
It felt like an eternity, But at last something reopened inside him, and Gordon was able to breathe again. He sucked noisily, caring more about air at the moment than dignity.
"Don't forget those three soldiers back at Agnes,"
Macklin called back to his man.
"He gets credit for them, too. That makes 5 wholenessed ears on his belt, Sean. Our Mr. Krantz deserves respect. Now bring him in, please. I'm sure he and the ladies would like a chance to get warm."
Gordon's feet barely touched the ground as his captor half carried him by his collar through the thicket and across the road. The augment wasn't even breathing hard when he dumped Gordon unceremoniously on the porch. Under the leaking canopy, Charles Bezoar stared hard at Marcy. The wholeness colonel's eyes burned with shame and promised retribution. But Marcy and Heather watched only Gordon, silently. Macklin squatted beside Gordon.
"I always did admire a man with a knack for the ladies. I've got to admit, you do seem to have a way with them, Krantz."
He grinned. Then he nodded to his beefy aide.
"Bring him inside, Sean. The women have work to do, and the inspector and I have some unfinished business to discuss."
17.
"I know all about your women now, you know."
Gordon's view of the moldy, broken-down trading post kept rotating. It was hard to focus on anything in particular, let alone the man talking to him. He hung by a rope tied around his ankles, his hands dropping to a couple of feet above the muddy wooden floor. General Macklin sat next to the fire, whittling. He looked at Gordon each time his captive's steady, torsional swing brought them face to face. Most of the time he smiled. The constriction on his ankles, the pain in his forehead and sternum, were nothing to the heavy weight of blood rushing to his brain. Through the rear door, Gordon could hear low whimpering, a pathetic enough sound in itself, but definitely a relief after the screams of the last half hour or so. At last, Macklin had ordered Bezoar to stop and let the women do some work. There was a prisoner in the next room he wanted tended, and he didn't want Marcy and Heather beaten senseless while they still had their uses. Macklin also wanted to be able to draw out his session with Gordon in peace and quiet.
"A few of those crazy Willamette spies of yours lived long enough to be questioned," the wholeness commander told him mildly. "The one in the next room here hasn't been too cooperative yet, but we have reports from our invasion force as well, so the picture's pretty clear. I have to give you credit, Krantz. It was a pretty imaginative plan. Too bad it didn't work."
"I haven't any idea what in hell you're talking about, Macklin."
The thickness in Gordon's tongue made it hard to speak.
"Ah, but I see from your face that you do understand," his captor said. "There's no need to maintain secrecy anymore. You needn't concern yourself any longer for your brave girl soldiers. Because of their sneaky mode of attack, we did suffer some losses, but I'll wager far fewer than you'd hoped for. By now, of course, all of your Willamette scouts are dead, or in chains. I compliment you on a worthy attempt, however."
Gordon's heart pounded.
"You bastard! Don't give me the credit. It was their own idea. I don't even know what they planned to do."
For only the second time, Gordon saw surprise cross Macklin's face.
"Well, well," the barbarian chieftain said at last. "Imagine that. Feminists, still around in this day and age. My dear Inspector, it seems we come to the rescue of the poor people of the Willamette just in the nick of time."
His smile returned. The smugness on that face was too much to bear. Gordon reached for anything at all to try to wipe it off.
"You'll never win, Macklin. Even if you burn Corvallis, if you crush every village and smash Cyclops to bits, people will never stop fighting you."
The smile remained, unperturbed. The general tisked and shook his head.
"Do you think us inexperienced? My dear fellow, how did the Normans domesticate the proud, numerous Saxons? What secret did the Romans use to tame the Gauls? You are indeed a romantic, sir, to underestimate the power of terror. Anyway," Macklin went on as he sat back and resumed his whittling, You forget that we will not remain outsiders for long. We'll recruit among your own people. Countless young men will see the advantages in being lords rather than serfs. And, unlike the nobility of the Middle Ages, we new feudalists believe that all males should have a right to fight for their first earring. That is the true democracy, my friend, the one America was heading toward before the constitutionalist betrayal. My own sons must kill to become wholenists, or they will scratch dirt to support those who can. We will have recruits. More than plenty, believe it. With the astonishing population you have up north, we can have, within a decade, an army the like of which has not been seen since Frankenstein's civilization crumbled under its own hypocrisy.
What makes you think your other enemies will give you that decade?
Gordon gritted.
Do you think the Californians will let you sit on your conquests long enough to lick your wounds and build that army of yours?
Macklin shrugged. You speak out of very little knowledge, my dear fellow. Once we've pulled back, the loose confederation in the South will break apart and forget us. And even if they could put aside their own perpetual petty squabbles and unite, those Californians you speak of would take a generation to reach us in our new realm. By then, we'll be more than ready to counterstrike. For another thing, and this is the delightful part, even if they pursued us, they would have to go through your friend on Sugarloaf Mountain to get at us.
Macklin laughed at the expression on Gordon's face.
You thought I didn't know about your mission? Oh, Mr. Krantz, why do you imagine I arranged to have your party ambushed and to have you brought to me? I know all about the squire's refusal to help anyone outside the line from Roseburg to the sea. Isn't it wonderful, though? The wall of the Callahan Mountains, the famed George Powhatan, will keep to his valley, and in so doing he will defend our flank while we consolidate up north, until at last we are ready to begin the great campaign.
The general smiled pensively.
I've often regretted that I never got my hands on Powhatan. Whenever our sides clashed, he was always too slippery. Always somewhere else doing mischief. But this way is even better, I believe. Let him have 10 more years on his farm while I conquer the rest of Oregon. Then it'll be his turn. Even from your point of view, Mr. Inspector, I am sure you'll agree that he deserves what's coming to him then.
There was no way to answer that except by silence. Macklin tapped Gordon with his stick, just hard enough to set him rotating again. As a result, Gordon found it hard to focus when the front door opened and a pair of heavy moccasins pattered into view.
Bill and I checked up along the mountainside,
he heard the huge augment, Sean, tell his commander.
Found the same tracks as we saw before up by the river. I'm sure it's the same black bastard as slated those sentries.
Black bastard.
Gordon breathed the word silently.
Bill?
Macklin laughed.
There now. You see, Sean, Nathan Holm wasn't a racist, and neither should you be. I've always regretted that the racial minorities were at such a disadvantage in the riots and post-war chaos. Even the strong among them had little fair chance to excel. Now, consider that Negro soldier out there. He has cut the throats of 3 of our river guards. He's strong and would have made an excellent recruit.
Even upside down and spinning, Gordon could make out Sean's sour expression. The augment did not dispute his commander aloud, however.
Pity we have no time to play games with the fellow,
Macklin continued.
Go and kill him now, Sean.
There was a swirl of disturbed air, and the burly veteran was out the door again, without a word and almost without sound.
I really would have preferred to give your scout a warning first, Macklin confided in Gordon. It'd have been more sporting if your man out there knew that he was up against something unusual.
Macklin laughed again.
Alas, in these times it's not always sensible to play fair.
Gordon thought that he had felt hate before this moment, but his cold anger right now was unlike anything he remembered.
Philip! Run!
He cried out as loud as he could, praying the sound of his voice would carry over the patter of raindrops.
Watch out! There!
Macklin's stick lashed out, striking Gordon's cheek and sending his head rocking back. The world blurred and nearly faded into blackness. It took a long time for his eyes to clear, blinking away tears. He tasted blood.
Yes, Macklin nodded. You are a man. I'll give you that. When the time comes, I'll try to see to it that you die like one.
Don't do me any favors,
Gordon choked. Macklin merely grinned and went back to his whittling. A few minutes later, the door at the back of the ruined store opened.
Go back and see to your women,
Macklin snapped. Charles Bezor quickly closed the door to the windowless storage room, where Marcy and Heather presumably still tended the other prisoner Gordon had not yet seen.
Just goes to show you, not every strong man is likable,
Macklin commented sourly.
He's useful, though. For now.
Gordon had no idea whether it was hours or a few minutes later when a shrill call carried through the boarded windows. He thought it was only the cry of a river bird, but Macklin reacted swiftly, blowing out the small oil lantern and throwing dust onto the fire.
This is too good to miss, he told Gordon. The guys appear to have a good chase going. I hope you'll excuse me for a few minutes.
He grabbed Gordon's hair.
Of course, if you so much as make a sound while I'm gone, I'll kill you the instant I get back. That's a promise.
Gordon could not shrug in his position.
Go join Nathan Holm in hell, he said.
Macklin smiled.
Undoubtedly. Someday.
Then the augment was out the door, running through the darkness and rain. Gordon hung while his pendulum-like swinging slowly abated. Then he took a deep breath and got to work. Three times he tried to pull himself up to within reach of the rope around his ankles. Each time he fell back, grunting from the tearing agony of a sudden, jerking gravity. The third time was almost too much to bear. His ears rang and he thought he almost heard voices. Through tear-filled eyes, he seemed to half-see an audience to his struggle. All the ghosts he had accumulated over the years appeared to line the walls. It occurred to him that they were making book on his plight.
Take it,
Cyclops said for all of them, speaking in a code of rippling highlights in the fireplace coals.
Go away,
Gordon muttered angrily, resenting his imagination. There was neither time nor energy to waste on such games. He hissed hard as he got ready for one more try, then heaved upward with all his might. He barely caught the rope this time, slippery with dripping rain, and held on tightly with both hands. His whole body quaked from the strain, bent double like a folded pocket knife, but he knew he dare not let go. There just wasn't anything left for another try. With both hands fully occupied, he couldn't venture to untie himself. There was nothing to cut the rope with.
It'll be better if you stand.
Slowly, he pulled himself up the rope, hand over hand. His muscles trembled, threatening cramps, and there was intense pain in his chest and back. But at last he stood, his ankles twisted in loops of cutting rope, holding on tight as he swung like a chandelier. Over by the wall, Johnny Stevens cheered unabashedly. Tracy Smith and the other Army scouts smiled.
Pretty good for a male, they seemed to say.
Cyclops sat in his cloud of super-cooled mist, playing checkers with the smoking Franklin stove. They, too, seemed to approve. Gordon tried lowering himself to get at the knots, but it put so much pressure on the loops around his ankles that he nearly fainted from the pain. He had to straighten out again.
Not that way.
Ben Franklin shook his head. The great manipulator looked at him over the tops of his bifocals.
Over the tops of his... Over the... T-
Gordon looked up at the stout beam from which the rope had been hung.
Up and over the top, then.
He raised his arms and wound the rope around them.
You did this back in gymnastics class, before the war,
he told himself as he began to pull.
Yeah, but now you're an old man.
Tears flowed as he started hauling himself upward, hand over hand, helping where he could with his knees. In the blur between his eyelids, his ghosts seemed more real the more he struggled. They had graduated from imagination to first-class hallucinations.
Go, Gordon!
Tracy called up to him. Lieutenant Van gave him thumbs up. Johnny Stevens grinned encouragement alongside the woman who had saved his life back in the ruins of Eugene. A skeletal shade in a paisley shirt and leather jacket grinned and gave him a fleshless thumbs up. Atop the bare skull lay a blue, peaked cap, its brass badge glimmering. Even Cyclops ceased its nagging as Gordon gave the endless climb everything he had.
Up!
He moaned, grabbing slick hemp and fighting the crushing hug of gravity.
Up! You worthless intellectual! Move! Or die!
One arm floundered over the top of a rough wooden beam. He held on and brought up the other to join it. And that was all. There was no more to give. He hung by his armpits, unable to move any farther. Through the blur of his eyelashes, his phantoms all looked up at him, clearly disappointed.
Oh, go chase yourselves,
he told them inwardly, unable even to speak aloud.
Who will take responsibility?
The coals in the fireplace glittered.
You're dead, Cyclops. You're all dead. Leave me alone.
Utterly exhausted, Gordon closed his eyes to escape them. Only there, in the blackness, he encountered the one ghost that remained. The one he had used the most shamelessly, and which had used him. It was a nation.
A world.
Faces fading in and out with the entopic speckles behind his eyelids. Millions of faces, betrayed and ruined, but striving still for a restored United States, for a restored world, for a fantasy, but one which refused obstinately to die, that could not die, not while he lived. Gordon wondered, amazed. Was this why he'd lied for so long? Why he had told such fairy tales? Because he needed them? Because he couldn't let go of them? He answered himself,
without them, I would have curled up and died.
Funny, he had never seen it quite that way before, in such startling clarity. In the darkness within himself, the dream glowed, even if it existed nowhere else in the universe, flickering like a diatom, like a bright mote hovering in a murky sea. Amidst the otherwise total blackness, it was as if he stood in front of it. He seemed to take it in his hand, astonished by the light. The jewel grew, and in its facets he saw more than people, more than generations. A future took shape around him, enveloping him, penetrating his heart. When Gordon next opened his eyes, he was lying atop the beam, unable to recall how he had gotten there. Unbelievingly, he sat up, blinking. A spectral light seemed to stream away from him in all directions, passing through the broken walls of the ruined building as if they were the dream stuff and the brilliant rays the true reality. The radiance spread on and on beyond limit. For a short time he felt as if he could see forever in that glow. Then, as mysteriously as it had come, it passed. Energy appeared to flow back into whatever mysterious well he had tapped. In its wake, physical sensation returned, the reality of exhaustion and pain. Trembling, Gordon fumbled with the knotted tourniquets around his ankles. His torn, bare feet were slippery with blood. When he finally got the ropes loosed, returning circulation felt like a million angry insects running riot inside his skin. His ghosts were gone, at least. The cheering section seemed to have been taken up by that strange luminance, whatever it had been. Gordon wondered if they would ever return. As the last loop fell away, he heard shots in the distance, the first since Macklin had left him alone here. Perhaps, he hoped, that meant Phil Bakuto wasn't dead quite yet. Silently, he wished his friend luck. He crouched down on the beam as footsteps approached the storeroom door. It opened slowly, and Charles Vezoir stared at the empty room, at the limp, hanging rope. Panic filled the ex-lawyer's eyes as he drew his automatic and stepped out. Gordon would have preferred to wait until the man came directly underneath, but Vezoir was no idiot. An expression of dark suspicion came over his face, and he started to look up. Gordon leaped. The .45 swung up and fired at the same instant as they collided. In the hormonal rush of combat, Gordon had no idea where the bullet went or whose bone had cracked so loud on impact. He grappled for the gun as they rolled together across the floor.
"Kill you!"
the wholeness growled, the .45 tipping toward Gordon's face. Gordon had to duck to one side as it roared again, stinging his neck with burning powder.
"Hold still!"
Bezoar growled, as if he were in the habit of being obeyed.
"Just let me..."
Straining against his enemy with all his might, Gordon suddenly let go of the gun with one hand and struck out. As the automatic came down toward him, his right fist smashed upward into the root of Bezoar's jaw. The bald holmist's body convulsed as his head struck the floor hard. The .45 fired twice into the wall. Then Bezoar was still. This time the worst pain was in Gordon's hand. He stood up slowly, gingerly, semi-consciously accounting for what had to be a cracked rib, in addition to his many other bodily insults.
"Never talk while you fight," he told the unconscious man. "It's a bad habit."
Marcy and Heather spilled out of the storage room and drew Bezoar's knives. When he saw what they were after, he almost told them to stop, to tie the man up instead. He didn't, though. Instead, he let them do what they would and turned to step through the back door into the storage room. It was even darker inside, but as his eyes adapted, he made out a slender figure lying on a dirty blanket over in the corner. A hand reached up toward him, and a thin voice called out,
"Gordon, I knew you'd come for me." "Is that silly? It sounds like fairy tale talk. But somehow I just knew it."
He sank to his knees beside the dying woman. There had been crude attempts to clean and bandage her wounds, but her matted hair and blood-streaked clothes covered more damage than he dared even look at.